November 27th, 2009, Billy Bragg, the legendary British folk musician and activist, along with his longtime manager, Pete Jenner, sat down with Black Mask, the Frequency of Resistance co-host and co-producer, Ethan Osland, at the Folk Exchange, to talk about Billy's career, his activism, and the importance of developing compassionate partnerships within the music industry. Billy Bragg was in Winnipeg to receive the Winnipeg Folk Festival's 2009 Artistic Achievement Award and to perform at the Burton Cummings Theatre. In this part two of a two-part interview, Billy and Pete speak in great detail about rights control issues that musicians face today with the music they create and other challenges that they have faced over the years. They also explain what the Featured Artist Coalition is and the issues that initiative confronts from within the music industry. The segment ends with Billy describing the Jail Guitar Doors project, which helps to get musical instruments into prisons in the UK, along with starting up music education programs for those prisoners.
Mixing pop and politics, he asks me what the use is. I offer him embarrassment and my usual excuses while looking down the corridor out to where the van is waiting. I'm looking for the right leap forward.
As we go into the digital age, it's no longer necessary for artists to sign life and copyright deals. In the old days, you had to sign a deal for whatever the record label wanted. If you wanted your records, if you lived in England, you wanted your records to be in a record shop here in Winnipeg, you had to sign a life copyright deal with a record label. You know, you had to sign everything away. Now, it's possible to not sign away stuff for life or copyright, to hang on to your rights. And that's something, that's a privilege that has come with the digital age. Well, since my career began in 1983, all of my albums have been on reversion. After 7 years, I get all my rights back to my records. And that's not because I'm a visionary genius, it's because Pete is a visionary genius. And he's understood that you know, the control that you have over your catalogue and your back catalogue is your future pension. I've took lesser advances because of that. But it's been Pete, that collaboration with Pete, that's made, that's why we, you know, we're still working together. He knows where all the bodies are buried. Or used to, anyway. I hope he hasn't forgotten. Tell him, Pete. Tell him.
Yeah.
Why, Pete? How did you realise in 1983 that it would be of great value 25 years later for me to have all my... The Mermaid Avenue stuff's just come back to us, I'm pleased to say, and we're working with Wilco on issuing the other 15 tracks you haven't heard yet. You know, so... It's just because you're an anarchist, aren't you, Pete? Go on, admit it. You're a public school anarchist.
Yeah, well, probably, yeah. No, well, I mean, I was brought up... My grandfather was a Labour MP in the 30s. That probably has a lot to do with it. And my father was a vicar heavy industrial sort of areas. So, I mean, you know, I'd always had was brought up in a very sort of socialist consciousness thing.
It's a bit rare among rock managers. Let me just say that for starters. Yeah. They're mostly nutcase money men.
And I think the thing which I realised was the contrast between Ian Dury and The Clash, which I think was really significant. The Clash were always going on about how they wanted to be free from the record company, and they never were. And they were always trapped by their relationship with the record company. And it screwed their relationship with me in the end, because of I thought that what was important was for them to get out of their the situation where they relied on the record company to advance the money. The moment you're relying on someone to advance money to you, you're in trouble. And that I could see that they could easily be self-sufficient, and they weren't able to get self-sufficient because of their contracts, because of all that stuff. And at the end of the day, they left me, I think, under pressure from the record company, because, you know, we'd spotted there was problems in their contracts and things like that. And so they screwed the relationship between my old partner, myself, and The Clash. And I think that was quite deliberate, because they could see that we were, as it were, trying to get what The Clash said they wanted to actually be a reality. And they fucked us. And it destroyed the company in the process.
But that's a crucial thing. Peter just said a really crucial thing there for what a manager should do. particularly for a political artist. You know, how do you talk about these things, but how do you actually, where are the places that these can happen? How do you understand the architecture of the industry to be able to make this happen? And this is where the important collaboration between the two of us has happened, exactly around what Pete said. His attempts to try against, with resistance from the industry, to make the things that I talked about happen. I mean, one of the earliest things we did was we used to put the a Pay No More price on the front of the album, actually printed into the sleeve.
They hated that.
They hated it. The record retailers really hated it, so they couldn't put their own price on it. And when they put us under a lot of pressure, and we might have lost sales over it, but ultimately, you know, we stuck. Whereas I know plenty of other artists that I work with during Red Wedge, you know, which was supporting the Labour Party after the miners, you know, people who I had a deep respect for, whose managers were going around saying, don't say that, son, you'll lose sales. Don't do that, they won't play your stuff on the radio. And then you can't be a political artist if you have if the people around you are trying to work in the opposite direction. So that's why this, you know, this collaborative process.
And I think it was that contradiction which broke up the Clash.
Mm, yeah.
The contradiction between what they said they were doing and what they actually did in their business brought in a contradiction. And in contrast with this, we had a deal with the Ian Jury by accident, which meant that he had total control over his content, over his records, and we always got paid, and we didn't get into debt. And I did, but Ian didn't. And you know, and that was the contrast. And I think that was, I was very aware of that because that was fairly recently. You know, when we started to work together, it was fairly recently after that had happened. And I really realized the important thing was owning your own recordings and your own writing, you know, that they really belong to you. Then you look after them and you look after your career and you realize that you're in this for the long run. It's not about how much money you can get out of the record company. Once you're into that state, then they own you.
I mean, we used to have some incredible rows with the label that I worked with for the first part of my career, Go Discs, where Pete and the guy who ran Go Discs, Andy McDonald, were under pressure from his major label distributor, although he was an indie, to sign me for, you know, 10 albums for life. And he and Pete would have screaming rows on the telephone, and we always resolved it the same way. Pete would send me in to see Andy. I would sit in Andy's office and I would say to him, Andy, morally, whose pension should these albums be, yours or mine, morally? And he would say, they should be yours, Bill. And so I'd sign the deal and get my rights back. And subsequently, you know, Andy McDonald sold that company to a conglomerate.
Series of people.
Several people, yeah. And, you know, none of us, you know, would still, I'm not there anymore, I'm not on the label anymore, he's not there anymore. Someone who none of us know would be owning my back catalogue now, were it not for Pete's you know, insight. And
most of it would be deleted.
Yeah, it would. Whereas getting it back every 7 years has allowed me to update my contracts with the change in technology. It's allowed me to exploit the opportunities that the internet offers. It's allowed me to be freer with permissions for other third parties to use my music in other projects that aren't necessarily, going to make a lot of money. Obviously, with TV and radio stations like the BBC, you get a set fee and that stands, but you have young filmmakers and other people who want to use
Benefit
my stuff.
Records.
Yeah, Benefit Records. It's given me a lot more freedom. And the potential for artists to do that is even greater now with the internet. I mean, the great thing about the internet is that it's bringing artists and the audience closer than ever before. I mean, when I first read that Dylan was influenced by a guy named Woody Guthrie, this is 1974, and I was a huge Bob Dylan fan. I could not find a Woody Guthrie record anywhere in East London in any record store. I eventually went into the West End and found a cassette, a French cassette, which spelt his name wrong and had no details on it apart from the track listing. I played it, and that was all I knew. Now, I was probably 15 then. If a 15-year-old finds out that their favourite artist is influenced by some old geezer called Billy Bragg, click, 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 there it all is, everything. Pictures, video, download stuff, where's Braggy playing? You know, almost could probably email me and talk to me almost as we're talking today. I mean, the potential for artists is incredible. But provided we hang on to our rights or we find some way to get our rights back, you know, the idea of digital-only deals and break down the old analog deal in which you signed everything away. You know, these kind of ideas. As artists, we should be coming together and putting pressure on the labels to break up the old way of doing business and find a new way that in which everybody gets what they want. The we get paid and make a living, the labels get some money, and the punters get access to the music that they want. And sorry, that was a very long answer. I'm sorry about that, Ethan.
Not a problem, because this segues perfectly into something I wanted to ask you both about, is the development of the Featured Artist Coalition. I wonder if you could explain to folks who might not know what that is, what the effort is.
Sure. A featured artist is someone who signs a recording contract. And in the UK, we've organised I suppose you might call it a lobby group, really, to intervene in debates that are going on at European level. Copyright law is made at European level in Britain. There's currently a proposal before the European Parliament to extend the term of copyright and recordings from 50 years to 70 years. We refer to it as the Beatles extension, for obvious reasons. But also, there's a very powerful music industry lobby that are trying to get the government to implement a free structure new out rule to disconnect people who download illegal files. And, you know, they're going after these kids in our name. Is this a good idea? Should we be criminalising our audience? Evidence suggests so far that, yes, millions and millions of files are being swapped by kids online, but these kids seem to be also buying more legal files than anybody else.
Going to more gigs.
Yeah, you know, basically we're seeding the next generation of music fans, and that's really, really important, because I know it's a long time ago, but when I was becoming a music fan, there were only two things you really could spend your money on, really. You know, there was music and football, really, you know. Now, you know, my son doesn't save up to buy CDs. He saves up to buy video games. You know, we live in a completely different economy. The opportunities for young people to get interesting stuff to do on their phones that are not music, that connect them together on Facebook. You know, music used to be a way of meeting girls. You know, it was finding out that all the girls in our class were going round to one of their houses at lunchtime to listen to David Bowie. That allowed me and my mates to overcome the idea that David Bowie was somehow a poofed and we shouldn't listen to him. All of a sudden, he became very attractive, and we all fell in love with Hunky Dory. So, you know, now you don't need that, because you've got Facebook to do that. You know, you've got other ways of making that. You know, the music was the social glue, I suppose. You know, that made all that, brought us all together. So, you know, we need to be encouraging people to listen to music, not trying to put them in jail or cut them off. It's ridiculous. But we've come to the conclusion that the music industry and the record labels, the major record labels, I stress, there's lots of little record labels who understand this, but the major record labels, in their negotiations with government and with new platforms like the phone companies and the ISPs, no longer represent our best interests. They have their own interests, and they're not necessarily the same as ours. So what do we do about that? I mean, you know, they're suing these people in our name. So really, we should be speaking out and saying, just a minute, is this a good idea? Let's look at what's going on here. You know, digital sales broke the record for single sales. Digital only downloads, 98% of downloads, broke the record for sales in 1 year in the UK with 10 weeks to go to Christmas this year. So, no, you know, yeah, people are sharing files, but they're also buying records. And it's weird, because, you know, the industry are insisting that the entire game is over. And you know, we can't do anything about it. And it's funny enough that the P2P activists are also saying the entire thing is over. I get into great arguments online with guys who say you can no longer sell copies of your work. Just give it away. And I'm like, yeah, but... You know, single sales are up, mate. I mean, it's not, what is happening is not logical. People, more and more people are getting into music as a result of the free availability of music everywhere. So the opportunities for artists are greater than ever to be able to propagate your music and have a career and you know, do that. The biggest trick that you can ever perform as an artist, the ultimate, is to make that step from doing a shitty job and playing music to actually making a living playing music. And if you can make a living playing music, that is the definition of success. Everything else on top of that is icing on the cake. If you don't have to go to work in the office or the car factory or driving a taxi or whatever it is, if you can make money doing the thing that you love, whatever it is, in my case, it's making music, then that's success. You've succeeded. And if you end up being top of the pops, brilliant, that's great. But just to be able to get up in the morning and know that you're earning your living and doing the thing you most wanted to do, and the internet makes that more possible. But it's also scary because it's going to have to be you. You know, you can't fall into the arms of a record company anymore and expect them to send a limo and all that gear. So it's, you know, it's a double bind, I'm afraid, but the potential is there. And the Featured Artist Coalition has come together. Our chair is Dave Rowntree, the drummer from Blur. Nick Mason of Pink Floyd is the co-chair. Ed O'Brien from Radiohead is on the board.
Three drummers,
yeah. Ed's a guitar player, Pete.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, Annie Lennox is on the board, myself, Mark Kelly, who's from Marillion, who's just been elected to the PPL, the collection body. So we're trying to start a debate and question the ideas that the music industry has put out, and we seem to be making some inroads.
I think that the story, it's really important that what has always happened is that the record companies and the publishers have gone to government through the years and said, we represent the creators. We are the people who represent the creators. Occasionally the unions would try and put their hands up, but would usually not be listened to. And the managers in the UK realized that we kept on hearing the record companies saying things which clearly weren't in the interest of our artists particularly. And in the name of our artists, so we would go in and say, no, it's not really quite like that because there's this and that and the other. And no one would take any notice of us. And we realized that the reason was that we didn't own any rights because the managers shouldn't own the rights in a permanent way like the record companies and the publishers do. And we realized that the only way that the artists were going to get properly represented was if the artists properly represented themselves. And that, I think, is a really important social lesson. It's right back to the real fundamentals of unionism.
Yeah. You've got to organise. I keep saying
it's hard work, and it distracts from doing gigs and playing your guitar and writing songs and all that stuff. It's a real pain in the arse. You've got to get to grips with legal stuff and read all sorts of unbelievably boring shit.
And the record companies put incredible pressure on you. I mean, there's a reason why it's a lot of old guys who are doing this, you know, who's had a career in the 80s and in the 60s and 70s, in the case of Nick. It's because the record companies haven't got any hold over us anymore. I mean, some of our younger members have been called in by their labels and told off. You know, just the idea of artists having the opportunity to speak is so unpopular that yesterday, the Daily Telegraph hosted a online discussion about the future of the music industry, which there were representatives from the British record labels there. And they refused to take part if our representative was there. And although we'd been invited and we'd been advertised 24 hours before, we were thrown off the panel. Because they just don't want people coming and saying, well, wait a minute, maybe peer-to-peer sharing is a bit like radio. Maybe the evidence suggests that these kids are sampling this music before they buy. You know, maybe the ability of kids to recommend to each other, it actually is a benefit much as it is a problem. I mean, you know, I do gigs at places all over the world, and I see kids, you know, who can't be more than 20 years old. How do they know about me? It's not because, I'm not in the New Musical Express anymore. I'm not on Radio 1 in my country, no. I'm not in those channels anymore. I can only imagine it's because there are kids out there who are looking for political music, and somehow they've managed to find me in a much, much quicker and a much more meaningful way than otherwise was possible beforehand, when it was a much more slow process, when you had to rely on, you know, the local import record shop and the, you know, the imported copies or the local journalist to pick up on stuff. You know, all those aspects are still going to be there. You know, the record labels are still going to be there. They're going to probably do a different job. The journalists still do an important job. The filters will still be there. But the ability of the artist to connect with all that and work through it and spread themselves out through different media and different linking sites, and not just Facebook, but other music social networking sites, is incredible. I mean, you know, the people, you know, sort of people that you work with, Propagandhi and these guys, right. and the Anarchist Collective and Radio Station, I'm sure you've got a huge network of people that listen and people that are active, that if an artist can access that, if an artist is making the music that fits in with those demographics, then the possibilities to be able to be you know, to make a record in England and be heard in Winnipeg is incredible. And that's a really important part of it as well. I mean, you know, when I was making records and doing gigs in my little area in London, I was kind of stuck in that little area in London because nobody knew me. And then John Peel played my record, and all of a sudden I could get gigs in Liverpool. I could get gigs in Glasgow. I could get gigs in Holland, even they could hear John Peel. So that ability to access those networks, although they might not be as big and national as Peel playing on Radio 1, those networks might be a bit more underground, but they are much more accessible now. If you're a kid who gets into the music that, you know, through maybe through listening to Propagandhi, you get into your network, you suddenly find there's loads of bands playing the stuff that you like. And that's really, really important. So these changes are, for the artists, are really, really positive. I don't know what the music industry will look like in 10 years' time, but I'm going to tell you this. There'll be people who want to make music and people who want to hear music. And the record industry better damn well reconfigure it around those two people, because they're the two most important people in the whole equation. You know, and provided we don't alienate our audience by siding with the labels when they attempt to prosecute people, then we have a good opportunity to build the kind of networks that allow you as an artist to make the music you want to make without compromising and having to make it sound like, you know, the producer at CBC or wherever wants it to sound like, which was the old thing that people used to throw at me. You know, I want the next Billy Bragg to be able to make a career, make a living, and make the music that he or she believes in without having to compromise for anything other than on their own terms. You do have to make compromises. Even when you're a political singer-songwriter, you do have to make compromises. But provided you make them on your own terms, I think that's acceptable.
I just want to say that people have always shared music. I mean, you know, I'm going back to the 60s. And I had a big record collection. It was about that wide, you know. And if I got a record, I would lend it to my friends. My friends would come over and listen to it. And if they got a new record, and vice versa. And, you know, now I've got God knows how many CDs, and no one comes around and listens to records with me, which is a real shame. But that was what we used to do. And then there was this whole thing about home taping is killing music, because when there got to be cassettes, we would cassette records to pass around, because a more efficient way of doing it. It's always been the way in which people have found out about music. If you've got your mate who likes the music that you like, and he hears or she hears something that they like, then you want to hear it because you'll probably like it. And I think that there's a real essence of peer-to-peer is that relationship. There's all sorts of other stuff going on top of it, and all sorts of weirdness with dubiosity, and you know.
But now you
but
don't,
that essence but, is still
but,
there.
But now you don't have to be in London to hear it. You know, no. I mean, when I first had my first album out, in order to find 1,000 Billy Bragg fans, I had to put a record in every record shop in Britain and hope. You know, give me 24 hours now, I could find 1,000 Billy Bragg fans in England over the internet. You know, and that is that's as revolutionary as Edison inventing the gramophone. You know, an incredibly revolutionary idea.
I think one really interesting thing from the point of view of business in the long run is that they worked out that when someone had bought a record by an artist, that when the next album came out, only 30% of the people who bought that previous album knew that it had come out. In the future, you'll probably be able to let something like 80%, 75% of the people who bought the record, you better say, hey, I've got a new record out. And they'll be pleased to get that information, and they will find a way of doing it. I mean, that is a really huge difference in potential.
Because before, you had to rely on your pecking order at the label, how important you were.
And the ads in the newspapers, you know, and getting on the radio, and the bribery and the corruption and all that stuff.
If you could indulge me in one last question before we get to the Q&A part. This last question has to do with one of society's largest taboos, is the rehabilitation of people that are incarcerated in the justice system. And you started up a project called Jail Guitar Door.
Yeah, Jail Guitar Doors, yeah, plural, yeah.
Could you, pardon me, would you mind explaining to
sure,
your audience about
sure.
that?
Sure, Jail Guitar Doors is the name of the B-side of the single Clash City Rockers, written by Mick Jones. And 2.5 years ago, I was contacted by a fellow working, a drug and alcohol rehabilitation officer working in a prison about an hour from where I live. And I think he'd read about some songwriting classes that I'd held with some women in a hospice in Weymouth, which had been in the local newspapers. And he asked me if I could come and talk to his inmates at the prison about songwriting. And if not, could I help him get some guitars? Because he had a real problem in trying to teach these guys guitar, in that he only had one guitar and it belonged to the vicar. And the vicar had to take it away to practice playing Kumbaya and stuff. So the men didn't have any access all week to the guitars. So as it happened, I couldn't go and do the songwriting classes, but I did sort him out with 300 quid's worth of acoustic guitars, six acoustic guitars. Took him along to the prison and saw the work he was doing. And you know, as a musician, I understand how playing a musical instrument can help you to momentarily transcend your surroundings wherever you may be. You might be, you know, at your parents' upstairs front bedroom like I was when I was growing up, or you might be in Guy's Marsh Prison in Dorset. But we all, as musicians, understand the value of that, to have that little bit of space in the day. So it occurred to me that there might be other people like Malcolm Dudley, who was the name of this guy, Malcolm Dudley, doing this kind of work in other prisons. And as a musician, that perhaps this is something that I ought to be doing. You know, I get asked to do all sorts of daft things to help people out, and all of them positive, all of them worthwhile, but almost all of them, you don't actually do it yourself. You raise the money and someone else goes and does the work. But here it seemed to me to be a thing where I could actually see that doing this work would actually have a positive. I could clearly see how that could have a positive effect, and I thought I really should try and do a bit of this. So using Malcolm's connections, I found a few more people who are doing this kind of work. And really, it's not people who are doing musical work. It's people who are already working in a prison and can play a guitar. In some prisons, it's people like Malcolm, drug and alcohol workers. Other prisons, it's the chaplaincy staff. It's the vicar and his people who can all play things other than Kumbaya. And in some of the really good programs, actually, they're run by the peak caps themselves, by prison officers who recognize that playing, sitting down with the men and playing an instrument can help to overcome some of the distance between them. So in the last nearly coming up for 3 years now, I've been into about 33, well, by Christmas it'll be 36 prisons in the United Kingdom. With guitars, raised about £30,000. Managed to get sponsorship from Gibson for a while to get cheap guitars. Now I have a new sponsorship from a British company. And I'm also pleased to say that Wayne Kramer, who's mentioned in the first verse of Jail Guitar Doors, has been in touch, and he's beginning Jail Guitar Doors USA. He's worked very closely. He's been in prison himself in California, and he's worked for a long time on rehabilitation issues in prison. He was in prison because he was a drug addict, and he has really grabbed this idea by the horns, and his connections with the correction system in the United States of America are already pretty strong, so he has the ability to get in there. And I'm even more pleased to say that as I've gone across Canada, I've met people who are interested in trying to do something like this here in Canada. Both at a musical level, but also at a political level. And I'm hoping that when I get home, I can connect people who are as far apart as Halifax, Nova Scotia and Vancouver, BC, into a loose coalition around the idea of local people raising money locally for local prisons, and finding people within the prison establishment who are doing this kind of work and helping them and servicing them. I had a lot of positive, just in the last 24 hours, people who read about me talking about it in the local paper yesterday came up to me at the event last night and were talking to me about it. The people at Mondragon, when I went in there for a cup of coffee yesterday, we were talking about it. So it's very much a portable idea. It's very much a local idea. What the model that Wayne has developed with my support for the United States of America is that he will talk to people on the Hill and he will find a sponsorship from a guitar company to get the guitars cheap, but the actual activism will be done locally by local bands, local musicians, working with local prisons. And I think that's a model that would work just as well in Canada. Obviously, your prison system works differently from ours. We don't have a federal and provincial relationship in the UK. It's a lot more straightforward. It's not the sort of thing you can run from the South Coast, but it is something that Canadian musicians are already thinking about getting involved in. So I'm hoping that by the time we get to South by Southwest, where Wayne's going to launch JGD USA, that we might have a Canadian component to come down to connect with us so that we can pull information and work together. It's not an idea that has a one particular way to do it. It's a kind of like a local thing. You do it your way, whichever way you do it is the right way to do it. But I can assure you that the effect that it has on both the prison population and you as a musician will be profound. I haven't taken any musicians into prisons who have not come out totally changed in their attitude towards the prison system. And the governor of Brixton Prison, which is one of the largest prisons we have in London, is on record as saying the introduction of musical instruments into the prison changed the atmosphere of the place. So it's worth trying. It's tough for musicians at a local level. You run into a lot of walls, brick walls, and you need someone in Ottawa on side to help you do this kind of stuff. And I'm already looking into that as well. I have some connections with specifically within the NDP that we might be able to knit together that kind of situation where you have activists working from below and pressure coming from above, because prison governors in the UK are always looking over their shoulder, don't want to do anything in the prison that might get them into trouble and might look as if they are being soft on their inmates. But those prisoners, those governors that have bought into the program have seen great benefits in the prison. And I'd like to think that as we are now, after 3 years in the UK, we have men and women now who have been released on probation who come and do gigs with us and who themselves go back into prisons and talk about their experience. I'd like to hope that a program here in Canada might be able to do the same kind of thing. We made a documentary called Breaking Rocks, which I was followed for the last 2.5 years by a filmmaker, and hopefully we might find some way of getting that out over here. If you want to find out some more, the website is www.jailguitardoors.org.uk, and I'll be trying to put information up there about connecting people in Canada and people in the United States of America to make something happen.
There are other efforts similar to Jail Guitar Doors that are currently active in Winnipeg. For those that are interested, there are two groups that are active on a specific project. The groups are called
the Elizabeth Fry Society
and the Anarchist Black Cross. They're both very active on going into prisons here in Manitoba, specifically the Remand Center downtown by the Law Courts building, and meeting with parents and getting specifically Aboriginal family members. Mm. And getting into establishing an archive of oral culture. So if there are folks here that want more information about that or would like to meet with those folks or have any involvement, meet me after the interview or get a hold of Chris and he can forward you, connect us together on that project.
It has been mentioned here in Canada, there is a disproportionate number of Aboriginal people in prison here, and that would have to be a facet of Canadian Jail Guitar Doors. So again, we do have, you know, I mean, to me, that's a reflection of a racist prison system. Well, obviously, we do have that problem in my country, but it's not with Aboriginal people. It's with people, you know, second or third generation immigrants. But yeah, that would be a really important aspect, I've imagined, of a Canadian initiative.
Absolutely. So let's wrap here, and let's thank Billy and Peter for their time, and then we'll take a quick minutes break, get them watered, and we'll hit the Q&A up after that. So thanks, Billy.
Thank you. Thank you.
This interview was produced by the Winnipeg Folk Festival, CKUW 95.9 FM, and Black Mask, the Frequency of Resistance. It was recorded by Cass Elliott and Ethan Osland, and edited by Ethan Osland.